You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, from Egypt to Ecuador via New Jersey and the El Mundo newsroom, we'll review the day's top stories with John Owen and Gavin McFadden here in the studio. Then we'll look at the changing face of Brazil's luxury market.
Brazil is proving to be a very interesting and profitable market for many luxury brands, and therefore it's time for them now to start directing their own operations.
And later in the show, we'll review the latest art exhibitions in Berlin and check in with our woman in Caracas. All that and more on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up here on the next hour of Midori House. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
Russia says opposition activists in Ukraine must end what it's called a campaign of ultimatums and threats. Officials in Moscow say they're bewildered by the continuing protests and accuse opposition leaders of trying to inflame the situation. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned he could halt financial aid to Ukraine until it's clear who is running the country. But it's reported the European Union and United States are considering large-scale loans to the country tied to commitments on political reform. A senior mediator has been removed from the next round of talks on Syria's civil war. It's reported Nasser al-Kedwa, who was a deputy to Lakhdar Brahimi, was removed after complaints from the Syrian government. Both sides are due to hold further talks in Geneva next week. Nabil El Arabi, the head of the Arab League, says he's hoping the next round will achieve real progress towards ending the violence.
The Arab League is 100% behind the Geneva final communique, which calls for a provisional period and that the country will be governed by a transitional governing body, which will be composed by mutual consent of the two parties. That's where we stand today.
At least one person has been killed in a suicide bomb attack in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. A number of others were injured in the explosion, which happened on a minibus during the evening rush hour. It's the latest in a series of attacks blamed by Lebanese officials on sectarian tensions linked to the civil war in Syria. Corruption across the European Union costs at least 120 billion euros a year, according to a new report. Europe's Home Affairs Commissioner says the real cost is likely to be far higher. The study found the highest levels of corruption reported in Spain, Greece, Romania, Croatia, and Cyprus. Electoral officials say that nine provinces in Thailand were unable to take part in Sunday's snap election because of protests. Across the rest of the country, fewer than half of those entitled to vote took part in the election. Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat is widely expected to win, as Thailand's main opposition group boycotted the poll. Italy is demanding India decide quickly whether it's to prosecute two Italian Marines suspected of murdering two Indian fishermen. It's claimed they were shot by the Marines on an Italian-flagged oil tanker. Lawyers claim the fishermen were mistaken for pirates and the Marines fired warning shots into the water. Stefan De Mistura, who's a special envoy of the Italian government, says it's taken Indian authorities far too long to make a decision.
Now it's time to take a decision. If the decision is to apply the two act, it would be an act of equating Italy and the Italian Marines to a terrorist state. We are hoping that the Supreme Court will take a decision very soon.
A review has been ordered of school security in Moscow after an armed student killed two adults and took more than 20 teenagers hostage. They were freed after his father went into the school to speak to him. Authorities say the pupil appears to have suffered an emotional breakdown. He was armed with two rifles, which were legally owned by his father. A deal to merge South Africa's main opposition party with a smaller group to fight this year's presidential election has collapsed after just 1 week. The Democratic Alliance announced last week that it would field the anti-apartheid campaigner Mampela Rampeli as its candidate in the election. But that's now been abandoned after members of her party said they hadn't been consulted. The leader of the Democratic Alliance, Helen Ziller, says she's disappointed.
I get lots of advice from people, mostly unsolicited. And in the end, you've got to listen to the advice, talk to the people whose advice you really trust, and make a bold decision. That doesn't guarantee it will always work, but you can't have an on-again, off-again process.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. And the time here in London now is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news are John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club and professor of international journalism at City University in London, and Gavin McFadden, the director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to actually start the show today looking at Egypt, where the act of reporting as that of protesting has become increasingly challenging. Yesterday, a court in Cairo acquitted over 60 Morsi supporters who were held since December for rioting. Among them was Al Jazeera cameraman Mohamed Bada. The news organisation has maintained that he was merely doing his job when he was arrested. Another 20 Al Jazeera journalists continue to face trial for conspiracy with the Brotherhood. So what can and should journalists do in this environment? Let me come to you first of all, John. When you get to this kind of situation, we know that the Al Jazeera journalists are being accused of entering the country with the wrong paperwork. But it seems unlikely that the Egyptians would give you the right paperwork anyway. What's the role of a journalist in a situation like this? Do you think that actually the reporting is so fundamental and so important to get out that you break the state's rules? Or do you try and comply, and if you don't get signed up and if you don't have the backing almost of the authorities, do nothing?
Well, at this point, it's hard to know exactly what they're charged with. I mean, they really were charged with talking to anybody who belongs to the Muslim Brotherhood. And right now, in the view of the Sisi government, that is talking to someone who's advocating terrorism. And that's where it stands. And there being anybody who is pursuing anything that appears to be critical of the government and in support or at least sympathetic to hearing from anybody who has anything to do with the Muslim Brotherhood is suspect. And it's not just journalists. You know, there are a lot of very fine bloggers and local advocates of free expression who simply publicly identified themselves with some kind of let's have a discussion about free expression, they've been thrown into the slammer as well. It's not just journalists. I think the big issue, and Gavin belongs to the Frontline Club, and what we're all talking about, and we have many prominent journalists, is what to do. How do you show solidarity in that kind of situation? If you show solidarity there, why don't you do something about the journalists languishing in Turkey and in Iran? Where do you draw the line? When do you pick and choose where to take a position?
I thought that the curious allegation about entering the country with incorrect paperwork was something that we would have heard in Russia in 1958, or in fact in India today. You know, no journalist, as far as I know, goes to India with correct papers, because you'd end up waiting at the border for 2 months for them to be cleared or to have to bribe officials. So, I mean, nobody in their right mind does reporting in countries that have difficult civil liberties traditions and has correct paperwork. I mean, when I was as a journalist in Czechoslovakia under the Russian occupation, we didn't have correct papers.
Because what we find, you know, I guess, here is you have to make a judgment. You know, so I know that we've done stories in places like, you know, Turkmenistan, again, where, you know, if you fill out a form saying you're a journalist and you're going to do reporting, well, you'll never get that visa. They don't want you there. And if they do let you in, you're going to be followed everywhere you go. So you have to take a judgment whether you go in as a tourist. But it becomes tricky, doesn't it? Because there are other situations where, you know, you take the judgment the other way and you think, the reporting isn't that essential, that there's the risk of someone ending up in jail isn't worth it. It's a very difficult line to hold, don't you think, John?
Well, I think if you've been reading what Peter Gress has been releasing in the way of statements, they're very thoughtful. They're not angry. They're not hostile. He's just simply trying to say, what is the role of a journalist? The question you're posing, and saying all we were doing is trying to proceed the way we would always proceed, and that is to try to find out what is going on between the government and those who still associate themselves with the Muslim Brotherhood. And for that, he was put away. There's one other thing. I was talking to Ron McCulloch, who runs Insight News Television. He had to deal with a situation years ago with Sory Sumura, who was in Liberia. And one of the reasons they arrested him and his crew was because they went into the hotel room and they found a kind of outline of people they were going to talk to and a kind of notion of where they were going with the story. And they collected that and they said, this showed bias in what you're going to do and who you're going to talk to. You're obviously not going to try to get the role of government. There's some suggestion that they may have also tried to lay that on the people that they arrested.
Gavin, in the end, the story coming out of Egypt, do you think that already the curtailing of the press's freedom means that the story we're getting is piecemeal at best?
Well, I think it'll drive the press underground, and it is piecemeal at best. It can't be anything else, because if you put your head above the parapet, you put yourself at great risk. So I think the public will lose a lot, and interestingly, those who are victims of the present government, and there'll be millions of them, won't have an expression abroad. They'll have no solidarity abroad because nobody will know what happened to them.
There's also the political aspect of this. Don't forget, too. I mean, the brunt of journalists being pursued work for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, owned by the Emir of Qatar. Qatar has allied itself with the Muslim Brotherhood, mm-hmm. and Qatar has a broken relationship right now with Egypt. That's also, you have to put it against that backdrop.
It also, interestingly, Tony Blair came out in support of the military dictatorship in Egypt this morning. So I think he'll be supporting, I would assume, the same activities that we're here being quite critical of.
Well, although you never know whether that's his kind of in there to try and broker some kind of deal. Well, we'll leave Mr. Blair. He's in more than
he's been so successful in the Middle East. Yes, and the rest of the Middle East.
He's got a great track record. We're going to turn our attention to kind of Russia now, where Edward Snowden continues to be holed up. And yet, his story may soon come to a bookshop near you, because the Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man by reporter Luke Harding, comes out in the UK this week. The US release date is February the 11th. The book tells the backstory of the Snowden scoop. Snowden himself continues to divide critics. Just a few days ago, Princeton historian Sean Villance published a piece titled, "Would You Feel Differently About Snowden, Greenwald and Assange If You Knew What They Really Thought?" In his piece, he claimed they were so engrossed in revelations a la WikiLeaks that we're all beginning to lose our eye of the leakers' much darker anti-government agenda. Wow. Well, there's a lot to get in here. Now, first of all, part of the Snowden book has already been published as a teaser online, and you can certainly read it on The Guardian's website. And I must admit, I kind of started reading the first lines with a kind of fear I was going to be weary. But a great yarn. Mm-hmm. Harding has turned it into a proper... It's a spy story. You're pulled through those first days of them. And actually, it turns out they were very slow to kind of pick up Snowden, was trying to get hold of them much quicker than they actually kind of took the story on. Do you think we're beginning to lionize? Gavin, do you think we're lionizing Snowden too much?
No, I don't think too much. We could lionize him a bit more, as far as I'm concerned. But I think only that somebody who's prepared to take enormous risks on behalf of what he regarded as a major issue of truth-telling and lies by government is a very valuable function. We've always recognized it in journalism. But interestingly, there are precedents for him that we forget about. There was, under Nixon's regime, a young man who, a typist at the in the military, who produced for Jack Anderson, who was a famous American investigative journalist in Washington at the time, an incredible document. And that document was the entire order of battle of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. And he wishes which ships had the thermonuclear weapons, the whole thing. I mean, serious stuff against a serious enemy, the Russian fleet, in a major war between India, Pakistan, and China. And yet, he wasn't even prosecuted, the kid.
Okay, well, I guess the nub of what's coming out at the moment is the idea, and I read the piece written by our professor at Princeton. His real claim is, I guess, the nub of his argument is, what all of these people don't like is the fact that sometimes states have to have secrets, and that's what they don't like, and that's what they will never understand. Do you think they're guilty of that?
Yes. And I think with some justice, because most of the secrets, because it's interesting, these pieces are all about them and their personalities, not about the information they release. It's interesting in that piece, as I remember reading it when it came out, there's very little about the actual information. What is it that he's actually putting out there? That there's illegal, massive surveillance of the American population and now the rest of the world, that hundreds of millions of files that they shouldn't have, they have. That we're now guilty of all kinds of crimes in the minds of somebody somewhere, because otherwise why would anybody collect all of our private personal information on the scale they're doing? And that's such a sinister development, an Orwellian kind of development, that unless you deal with that, whether you find the person who did it despicable or not is another matter.
John, is it despicable or is it just banal collecting so much information?
Well, I mean, I think there are two things here. It's, you know, actually what happened, the information was released, and what was the value for the public welfare? I mean, what did we learn from all of that? And then there is the issue Ellens and others are trying to raise is, you know, we really ought to know something more about these guys. In reading his article and reading the extract of Harding, there are a couple things that bother me. I'd be curious to know if actually it bothers Gavin. Does it make any difference to you, Gavin, the politics of the guy? For example, points out that Snowden in 2009, when he was inside the NSA, was deeply critical of the New York Times. Wanted, he said, having their cojones shot off for releasing information that could have damaged the pursuit of something with Iran. He thought that the New York Times gave away secrets that could help the Iranians against Israel and so forth. And he was furious, so he took a completely different position. A Greenwald was tied to a law firm, according to Villens, that did some dodgy things. I mean, do we need to know this, or is that irrelevant?
I think it's helpful to know what people do and where they do it and how they do it. But I think the real issue is what he said true, and is it of consequence? That's the real issue.
So you really don't care about their politics prior to the release?
I care a little bit, but it's more of a personal interest than anything else, certainly not a journalistic interest. The issue is whether they told the truth or not. And I think of that, there's no denying it. So the information they've come out with is extremely damaging to the American claims of being impartial and all the rest, and constitutionally democratic and all the rest. And I think that's what motivates these endless attacks on them. And I think we'll find from Snowden there'll be similar attacks coming up now in great number.
We're going to move on in 1 second, but just tell me, you know, the other element, I guess, is, you know, that the American state is not going to stop collecting information. It's just going to collect it in a different way. So, you know, have these revelations really changed anything, or do they just mean that the, you know, the security forces have gone away and rethought their, you know, their tactics?
Well, think of it this way, that nobody in their right mind objects to a government focused attacks on an individual. You can do anything you want when you're going after an individual or a small group of people who you think have done something bad. You're entitled to survey them. You don't get to survey entire populations. That's another matter. And I think then the risk, the political risk of that kind of enormous control, because after all, information is power. And if you give that quality of information to a government that isn't responsible, you're in deep trouble. And I think that's one of the key fundamental civil liberties issues you have to confront. Governments are going to keep secrets whether we want them to or not. But it's secrets about what? And I think unless they're subject to a public overview, we're all in trouble.
Well, another question of truth now, because we're going to head to New Jersey, a story that's been rattling on for a few days now. Things are starting to look rather bad for Governor Chris Christie. He's accused of orchestrating a giant traffic jam to bully the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee, the man who once wooed crowds and was booed at the Super Bowl this Saturday, as a new source came forward to say that the governor knew about his team's plan to close lanes and create a giant traffic jam on the George Washington Bridge. But Christie blames his fall from grace mainly on the New York Times. There they are again. In an email obtained by the website Politico, the New Jersey governor attacks the New York Times for alleging that they had received evidence, while their source actually only claimed that evidence of Christie's knowledge exists. Okay, so here we are. We're saying there's not quite the dirt, but the dirt is kind of out there. Is this bad for the New York Times, John? You know, they have had to kind of admit that they're kind of editing on the hoof a bit when these stories break, and you know, and Christie seems to have landed well, not a very big punch, but a kind of a pudgy punch.
I don't think it's much of a punch at all, Mike. I'll tell you, the real indicator was last night at the Super Bowl. Apparently, in New Jersey, in his home state, he walked out and they booed him, started yelling, you know, get off the highway, get off the bridge. You know, they were just shouting at him. And the second thing is, his hero of all heroes is Bruce Springsteen. And I saw Springsteen doing a duet with somebody mocking him. I think that's far more important than the New York Times being slightly imprecise about they reported on his source.
Gavin, we're not going to dwell too long on this again. Is this just a kind of another boring blip in the tail? Or do you think that Christie is right, actually, that there is a kind of a problem the way stories break now, that there is a rush to get them onto websites, and that actually maybe a level of verification even that would have happened in the 24 hours it would have normally taken a newspaper to come out doesn't happen now? So actually, the New York Times is doing a lot of changing on the hoof.
I think that's probably true, but I think the issue is the story itself is so thin that it hardly warrants even the attention we're giving.
Okay, well, that's the end of that story then. I think we'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck. And have no fear, John Owen and Gavin McFadden will still be here when we return, I think, anyway, because then we're going to head to Ecuador next. Stay tuned.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club, and Gavin McFadden, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism. Now we're going to head to Ecuador next, where one cartoonist's freedom of speech is in jeopardy. Javier Bonilla has 3 days from now to issue a correction to one of his drawings deemed to have defamed the government. The paper that published the cartoon has also been fined. Bonilla's cartoon criticised a police raid on the home of Fernando Villavicencio, a journalist and opposition deputy assistant. The paper has agreed to pay the fine, but Bonilla plans to challenge the order. An interesting story, I guess, out of Ecuador. But I guess the most important thing, maybe, Gavin, I'll start with you, is, you know, the power of the cartoonist. There's something still oddly powerful about a cartoon that often wounds somebody who's a bit kind of uppity in power more than actually the written word.
I think that's true. I think it's true in most countries, and I support it. I think it's an excellent craft. I wish I had been a cartoonist in my life. But I would think here, though, it's important that there's been an ongoing campaign for quite a long time to characterize the Ecuadorian press as this humbled group of people under the whip of an authoritarian regime, when, in fact, there are certainly problems there, and I wouldn't defend the government for a second. But on the other hand, compared with most countries in Latin America, it's a bastion of freedom. I mean, in Brazil next door, journalists have been killed, tortured. The radio stations burned down. In Venezuela, the same. In Peru, the same. I think it's the number of deaths in Ecuador is non-existent.
Well, maybe number of deaths, but it's still not very helpful. And the government kind of gets a bit annoyed because you've kind of drawn a kind of an upsetting cartoon. Do you look at the political cartoons, John? Do you think they still serve a purpose today?
They do, and it's a reminder, again, in many parts of the world that even though you may have a rule of law, sort of, cartooning and satire are still seen as poisonous as a defamatory piece or a tough-minded political piece. You know, we keep forgetting that in places where we celebrate, you know, whatever we see, the most trenchant drawings and commentary. And looking at his cartoon, interestingly enough, though, the cartoon reminds me more of something by Joe Sacco. It looks like a graphic art piece. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like a kind of play on words. It's a pretty tough-minded little progressive narrative with drawings that really did give truth to the charge that this action had taken place. Mm-hmm. So you can see why the authorities were furious. It was more than just a little clever commentary.
But Gavin, you see a bit of conspiracy here. You kind of feel that it's kind of, you know, this story is a bit of a smokescreen because, in fact, Ecuador should be kind of admired a little bit.
Well, I don't think it's particularly admired, but it certainly shouldn't be castigated any worse than the other country in Latin America, particularly, where freedom of the press is a very devious business. But just say this, though, about it. I think that the curious thing about that press is that it's uniform. There's almost no opposition to itself in the press. The uniform press, by that I mean, that tends to be almost exclusively on the hard right against what is a liberal lefty government. So it has that credibility to the Americans, but probably not to very many other people.
John?
I had Marcela Pizarro, who works for Listening Post, knows a lot about Latin America. And then she did this whole presentation about the narrative in Latin America, which is, you know, the right-wing oligarchical press against the so-called left-wing government. And again, you have to almost go through country by country and situation by situation because you can make some big generalizations.
Sure. We're going to jump now to Spain. We've just got a few minutes left before the bottom of the hour. The founder of El Mundo, Pedro J. Ramirez, has been ousted from the paper's editorship. He says he's received the boot because he dared report about corruption allegations linked to the government of Mariano Rajoy. Others say his departure is mostly linked to the paper's big dip in circulation. And I must just say, I've just been looking at those numbers. He's somehow managed to lose a good 25% of sales in 10 months. So again, it's certainly not just a kind of a simple story here. Do you think when we come closer to home in Europe, that political influence on who gets to edit a newspaper is still being played out? Gavin?
I think it's an issue everywhere. And I think what's interesting here is that the press on the whole is on the defensive because of a reduced advertising revenue and all the rest. So, I mean, how much the actual decline would represent his editorial policy and how much would be the failure of acquiring sufficient advertising to run the paper, I don't know.
It's owned by an Italian group too, isn't it?
Yeah, and apparently they've injected some 400 million euros to keep their kind of Spanish operations up and running. The loss of readership is fascinating because apparently the other leading newspaper, El País, who we've spoken to their editor many times, and a very inspiring editor, again, who takes a very tough line against Rajoy and has run lots of stories criticising the government. They've seen an 18% decline in newspaper sales. I wonder when you're running one of these economies where, you know, there is only tough news and you are endlessly reporting kind of like 25% unemployment, whether it's hard to keep people engaged with their newspaper in a way, because, you know, we don't want to turn to our newspapers for soft stories, but when it's endlessly bleak, I wonder if, you know, there is a kind of an unwillingness on some Spanish people just to read the news a little bit. Do you think, John, it's complicated when you're running a newspaper where in a country that has just endless tough stories?
Yes, and we, you know, again, we don't know what kind of pressures there were, again, from the Italian owners to do exactly what you're saying, you know, turn this around, would do a different kind of news agenda. Maybe he wanted to stay with his political reporting. I don't know enough about the actual what's going on inside his paper. You know, we'd really need to talk to some of the reporters inside and analysts. I think you should get a commentator from Spain to pursue this.
Okay, well, I think we've decided that it's a tough time to be Mr. Christie. Certainly a tough time to be a journalist, and probably not the easiest of evenings, even for Mr. Snowden, despite his success at breaking so many headlines around the world every day at the moment. A big thank you to John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club, and Gavin McFadden, director for the Centre of Investigative Reporting here in London. They've been my co-hosts here for looking at today's top stories. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our woman in Caracas. We're going to look at the changing face of Brazil's luxury market. And we'll talk with our correspondent in Berlin. But before all that, we're going to have a slight pause and then we'll have Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 18:30 and it's time now for the news headlines with Paul Osborne.
Russia has called on opposition activists in Ukraine to end their demonstration, saying it's become a campaign of ultimatums and threats. Russian President Vladimir Putin's already warned he could halt financial aid to Ukraine. But it's been reported today the European Union and United States are now considering offering their own large-scale loans tied to commitments on political reform. A senior mediator has been removed from the next round of talks on Syria's civil war. Nasser al-Kidwa, who's a deputy to the chief UN official of the talks, Lakhdar Brahimi, it's reported he was removed after complaints from the Syrian government. At least one person's been killed in a suicide bomb attack in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. A number of other people were injured in the explosions, which happened on a minibus during the evening rush hour. Corruption across the European Union is costing at least 120 billion euros every year, according to a report published today. Europe's Home Affairs Commissioner says the real cost is likely to be far higher. The study found the highest levels of corruption in Spain and Greece. And electoral officials say that nine provinces in Thailand were unable to take part in Sunday's snap election because of demonstrations. Across the rest of the country, fewer than half of those entitled to vote took part in the election. Thailand's main opposition group had boycotted the poll. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. And Paul's going to be back in another 30 minutes with a full bulletin. And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time now is 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, which means it's 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Venezuela, where our Caracas correspondent, Irene Caselli, has the week's top stories. Hello, Irene.
Good, hi there.
Good to speak to you. Now, I want to jump straight in. We spoke just last week about this incredible story. There's not enough newsprint in the country for many of the newspapers to print themselves. Now comes a story that there's a law on fair prices has been passed, which means that shop owners can't earn more than 30% of their turnover in profits, I believe. Just tell me how this kind of is meant to work in a day-to-day way.
Well, it's actually a very, very good question. This is something that shop owners are actually asking themselves at this very moment. The law, as you mentioned, of fair prices just came into effect last week. And the language used in the law is actually pretty vivid when it comes to how the government will check profits, especially, for example, in cases such as publishing houses or writers or newspapers or airlines, where the profit is not as obvious as, for example, with importers who can make a maximum of 30% from what they've spent importing some items. So shop owners are still asking themselves this. They're worried because just in November, the government was very strict about going into shops and alleging that most shop owners were actually inflating prices. And we spoke about this several times. The government actually occupied electronic stores and forced the owners to slash their prices. Now, several shops around Caracas actually have little signs on their doors saying, "We're complying with the fair prices, come in, we've got fair, good prices, Bolivarian prices." But just over the weekend, government officials were going around the city to check whether that was the case. So far, no arrests have been made, but there's a lot of worry here that this might affect business even more.
Well, it's a complicated law that turns policemen into accountants. Can I ask you, on a day-to-day basis, so you're living there in Caracas, we hear these stories again and again. We know that things have been even more complicated since the death of Hugo Chavez, and Maduro seems to have a very tough time. Could you just give us a little bit of colour day-to-day? Are you noticing a deterioration in the situation? Are you noticing, actually, shopkeepers more nervous? Are you noticing fewer things in the store? How is it impacting on your day-to-day life, these changes that we're discussing?
Well, on a day-to-day life, on a day-to-day basis, people are queuing constantly in shops to find basic items. We're talking about toilet paper, we're talking about milk, we're talking about sugar. So, for example, you know, in order to get your total, your complete groceries list checked, you probably have to go to 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 shops. And so, for example, one thing that happens is that when you see toilet paper in a store, you probably text your friends, your family, and you let them know that that store at that very moment has got toilet paper. So if you go into the store, for example, you can only buy a maximum amount of sugar, toilet paper, or milk because the shops are trying to avoid situations where people go in, buy everything, and then there's not enough for everyone. So on a daily basis, this is obviously very complicated for Venezuelans. And you can see stores becoming empty. Importers are importing less because they're worried. They're unclear whether they'll be able to make any business. And at the same time, others are taking advantage and they are pushing prices up for, you know, import items that the government won't necessarily check on, like, you know, foreign whiskey or that, you know, it's sold a lot here in the country or, you know, kind of luxury items.
And is there a kind of a way of getting around it? I wonder, you know, middle class people who can't afford to, you know, run around stores all day trying to find toilet paper, do people pay on the black market to get products? How does it work, you know, for the middle classes in Venezuela?
Yeah, the middle classes are being particularly squeezed by the current economic situation, but that's definitely something that happens. There are several markets where items such as toilet paper can be bought on the black market, so at higher prices. So for certain people, that's probably, that doesn't make that much of a difference to their, you know, because of their salaries are higher, but for others, for poorer people, it's very hard to buy things on the black market. And otherwise, that's the thing. There's even an app for smartphones that lets you know where toilet paper can be found around you, and it all depends on people going to shops and then, you know, sending a message to the app saying, at this store right now, there's toilet paper. So there's definitely a lot of creativity around getting your groceries done and a lot of frustration as well.
Now, a very different story. I know the one that you wanted to touch on is the story that huge number of stray dogs in Caracas and in Venezuela. And there's an attempt to kind of sterilize them, to set up the first kind of animal hospitals and to supposedly take care of these animals a bit more. How big a problem is that in Caracas? Are there kind of stray dogs hanging outside your apartment?
Not right by my apartment because I'm in an area that that is a bit better care of. But in certain, you know, especially marginal areas of the city, there are definitely loads of stray dogs. According to some unofficial figures, I was talking to the government official in charge of this. He was saying that they think that there's probably 2 million stray dogs in the country. So that's quite a lot. And there's there's been so far no sterilization effort, and there's been no effort whatsoever to create hospitals for stray dogs. So this is something that the president Maduro says that actually was part of the plan that Mr. Chavez put forward, because there's this big plan to make Venezuela an ecological country where even dogs and cats are taken care of.
And finally, an interesting story. There's a part of Venezuela that's hoping to be in the Guinness World of Records because it's got the most lightning strikes anywhere in the world.
Yes, this place is called Catatumbo, and it's in the western part of Venezuela around Lake Maracaibo. And I haven't been there myself, but I've seen pictures, and it's absolutely incredible. 240 nights a year. There are as many as 25 or 50, up to 50 flashes per minute. And this is apparently due to several factors, including humidity, the elevation, and the winds. But basically, this area has become very important, a major tourist attraction. And as we just managed to snatch the record, the Guinness record for the most lightning from a town in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Big tourist attraction, but I presume they tell you not to kind of bring anything metal or a giant kind of umbrella with you.
Probably not that advisable.
Irene, really great to speak to you. That was Irene Caselli, who's Monocle's woman in Caracas. Up next, we'll discuss the changing face of Brazil's luxury market. Stay tuned for more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Contemporary Czech designers are embracing age-old bohemian glassmaking traditions and mixing in new techniques to create modern products with soul. Monocle Films pays a visit to some of the country's most clear-thinking glass alchemists.
Original decoration, this is very difficult, and it must be about emotions. And if I'm teaching students, I'm speaking about mentality of glassmakers, that it's not good to be proud only. Artists must be humble too.
Clear vision, check glass. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. In the past 10 years, Brazil has become one of the major players in the luxury market. Yet, the country faces many problems to continue that push, mainly because of incredibly complicated laws and taxes that make luxury items in Brazil some of the most expensive in the world. That's why 80% of what Brazilians buy from luxury brands is bought from abroad. But over the last year, a new trend has emerged. For the first time, luxury brands can oversee their sales in Brazil directly. Until now, they needed to have a Brazilian intermediary in the country. So what does this mean for the likes of Louis Vuitton and Hermes, who are trying to conquer Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo? Amon Armoni, the head of postgraduate fashion programs and MBA in luxury markets at FAAP in Sao Paulo, spoke to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
I think it's a natural progression for luxury players. We all know that for luxury products and for the luxury market, it's very important that you do have control over your retail with the DOSs, right? Directed Operated Stores. The strategy, however, for emerging countries such as Brazil used to be, is to start with someone else running your business in conjunction with you, and then you may or may not go into the DOSs. That's what's going on. Brazil is proving to be very interesting and profitable market for many luxury brands, and therefore it's time for them now to start directing their own operation. And that's what's going on at Ferragamo, and I suspect that's what's going to happen also with Hermès in the future and with most stores. Dior, as a matter of fact, and it's a natural progression for markets that are showing growth and therefore require a very strong management and control.
Amnon, do you think this new move by those luxury brands will make their own products a little bit cheaper? Because, you know, as you probably know, in Brazil, it's quite expensive to buy luxury products, more so than when you buy in Europe.
Yes, the reason for that has nothing to do with the brands or the companies themselves. It has to do with the very strict import and barriers to entry policies coming from Brazil, which makes luxury brands, international luxury brands, suffer a lot to continue doing business in Brazil. You may ask me why they are still here, because this is one of the most important markets and growing markets. However, there is an astonishing number, a percentage, believe it or not, 80% of all luxury goods purchased by Brazilians are done so abroad, meaning only 20% of luxury goods purchased by Brazilians are made in Brazil. So, again, the reason for that is the import barriers, tariffs that are very, very high, the highest among emerging countries Brazil has. A product can cost 80% more in Brazil than what they cost in Europe or in the United States. So that's a very, very difficult problem for these companies to face.
And of course, in Brazil, we have this kind of, I think it's the only country that you can buy a Montblanc pen or a Louis Vuitton bag and you can pay in installments, right?
Absolutely. Listen, this is cultural and it's unheard of when you talk about luxury and what it stands for, the philosophy behind it. But now we are dealing with the cultural differences. And in Brazil, that's how Brazilians are used to do shopping. And most of the luxury brands, if not all of them, operate in installments to follow what the culture is in Brazil.
Well, that was our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco there. And he's joining me now in the studio. Fernando, 80% up on prices that you'd find elsewhere on the world. It's tough then to get people. How do they ever persuade people to get out their ray eyes if it's so expensive?
Well, they're lucky. There's still 20% of Brazilians who buy in Brazil, and you know why? Because I mean, one of the reasons is this thing that you can pay in installments. I mean, as Amnon was saying, this is the only country where you can do that because prices there are so kind of abusive. I know it's not. You can't blame only the brands. It is the way the country works. I mean, there's so many taxes. It's really, really difficult.
Try buying a copy of Monocle on the newsstand.
God.
I think it's like $20-odd.
Yeah, well, now it's a little bit cheaper. It did improve, but it's still quite expensive. But, you know, they do service champagne. They have great service. I mean, that's the good thing about Brazil. They treat you so well that, I mean, you might end up buying something just because you're so well treated.
Because lots of the women's wear stores, they have a kind of the equivalent of a maid almost to run around and get stuff for you and look after you. There's a valet to kind of look after your car when you park outside.
Exactly. And of course, we had a lot of cases that didn't really work in the end. For example, Dasloo, which was one of our few department stores. Basically, they had some problems because of the law, some taxes here and there.
I think problems involve somebody going to jail, actually. But yeah.
I'm trying to be careful with my words exactly. I mean, they still exist, but now they have just small shops inside malls. And actually, this is something else that I would like to discuss with you, Andrew, how this, for example, all these major brands, now they want to move to shopping malls, which I think it's a little bit sad because, you know, in São Paulo...
What's the famous road in São Paulo for that, your Bond Street, your Fifth Avenue?
Oscar Freire.
Okay.
And I was there just there in January and it's a very recent thing, just in the last year. So basically they had Dior, Giorgio Armani, Cartier, and all those brands now they move to shopping JK or Iguatemi. So it's a really, it's a really interesting move. So... I think it's quite sad, to be honest, because I prefer to be in the street than in an air conditioned shopping mall.
I apologize, I had a fashion sneeze there. but tell me, I was there, and actually, there's a great bookstore that we used to always go to in magazines to shop, which had disappeared as well the last time I was there. Now, the other issue, I guess, is when you park in the center of Sao Paulo on the street and you run from shop to shop with your bags, The security issue is actually one that people take very seriously. And I guess that's the other lure, is it, of going to a shopping mall where you enter into some kind of underground car park through kind of security gates, and then you're surrounded by security guards as you do your shopping.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. But to be honest with you, like, I don't know if you heard about this new thing called Rolezinho, where the young people from the favelas, yeah, they go to shopping centers. And actually, the shop in JK, which is one of the most chic and glamorous shopping centers in São Paulo, they had to close for 2 days because they were scared of so many young people outside. I mean, they were not practicing any sort of crime, but they were scared of so many people. So, I mean, I think even in a shopping center, you still need to be a little bit scared somehow. And I think it's a shame. And of course, there's another reason why they're leaving Jardins, because the rent price there, it's incredibly expensive. So it's much cheaper for a brand like Louis Vuitton to go to a shopping center.
Well, I was told actually by somebody who works for the Madrid Tourism that the best spenders in Madrid, when they're there on holiday, are the Brazilians. They get their credit cards out and they shop. They're very professional shoppers.
Because in their mind, it's cheap after looking at the prices in São Paulo. So they go there and say, yeah, let's pen it over.
Well, Fernando, thank you very much for coming to join us. Don't go just yet, because we're going to, you can help me with the next bit, because we're going to have a bit of music now, which is also Brazilian. I'm told it has a bit of a fashion connection. It's a group called Stop Play Moon. And they have a lead singer who's a model.
She's a model, and she's a very exotic model, Andrew. I mean, if you
what does exotic model mean?
Does she take her clothes off? Well, our sound engineer, he didn't like her that much, you know. But she has an interesting nose.
Did he see her with her clothes off? Then is it that kind of exotic?
Well, he could see
okay. That's Chris Chilvers. Okay.
But it's a good song. It's called Little Joy, and I like it. Let's dance a little bit.
Well, that was Stop Play Moon with Little Joy. And next, we're going to go over to Berlin. Well, kind of Berlin, because we're fast approaching the end of Monocle 24. And it's time for our daily review segment, where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors around the world. And today, it's the turn of Kimberly Bradley, who's normally in Berlin. But Kimberly, I hear you're up a mountain somewhere in Austria.
I'm on a mountain called the Wimmau, which is north of Kitzbühel.
I presume with some skis strapped to your feet.
Yes, of course.
Okay, good. Okay, well, let's see if you can take us over the Mogul Hills of Berlin fashion. Berlin fashion, Berlin art, rather. We're going to start with the show of John von Bergen. He's got a German name, but he's not German, is he?
He's American. He is from Connecticut, and he's been in Germany for about 10 years. He's actually a friend of mine. And his latest exhibition, I would say, is the best I've ever seen from him. He does this crazy sculptural work, you could say, that's a bit like a stage set or sci-fi. It kind of borders on like horror movie stuff. In this particular show, one wall just bursts open, and there are metal pieces sticking out and plaster, and it looks like some sort of creature has come in and torn the place a bit apart. But it's very intriguing because he's dealing with reality and surreality.
And tell me, are these pieces on a vast scale?
The big wall, there are some of them that are a little bit smaller. You see like little bumps coming out of some of the secondary walls in the gallery. But the centerpiece of the exhibition is one central wall where honestly it's been busted through, and there's a large, large metal stake coming through, probably 3 meters long. Yeah, it's big.
Okay, well, let's move on. Angela Bullock was somebody who had some success here in the UK. She was one of the so-called YBAs, the young British artists, who are all quite old now. Thankfully, they've matured a little bit. What's her work like as it's grown older? I see that she does social sculptures.
This most social sculpture in the current show she has at Gallery Esther Schipper are things that she calls happy sacks, which I think she started doing 20 years ago. You know, remember the hacky sacks that people used to kick around?
Yes, I think we called them bean bags.
Yeah, well, these are like the most massive beanbag chairs you can possibly imagine. And they're meant
to be seating for gallery visitors to look at the other works, which are very geometric. She's working with rhomboid figures in both two-dimensional work, wall hangings that look very geometrical, and then sculptures that look a bit like totem poles. Very strange, a little bit unlike her, actually. You can sit in these hacky sacks and look at those, or look at a machine that's doing curvy drawings on the wall. But all of these things are re-editions of things she's done earlier in her career.
I've just called up a nice picture of one of these, the bean bags, as we call them. Big, very big, orange,
okay.
Nice colors. I love having a sit down when I'm looking at ours. That's tempting. Can we move on, though? Another Brit who's making it kind of big in Berlin. Is it Eddie or Edie Peake? How do you say that?
Eddie Peake. He's young. He was born in the 80s. And the show he's got at Perez Project, Perez Project is a gallery that is run by Javier Perez from Los Angeles, really messes with the gallery architecture. He's set up all these walls throughout the whole entire space that the visitors have to navigate through. And throughout all of them, they see like a large collage on one wall that looks like it's made out of old clothing, but it's sprayed with neon spray paint. And then there's a little plexiglass sculpture that looks like a little gecko wearing a top hat. And you wander and you see many of these things. And then underneath you feel this sound installation that's coming from the basement that's very terrifying. He's created the first use of the basement of the gallery space by using sound art.
And I understand your daughter was a little bit kind of petrified.
She wouldn't let me go downstairs. No, she loved the neon pieces upstairs, but no, downstairs was not working for her. It scared her away. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, you've taken us down the black run of art in Berlin, and we shall allow you now to kind of schlup, 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 from whatever they call it in German, off. Thank you very much. That was Kimberly Bradley, who, of course, is our correspondent in Berlin. And, well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, John Owen and Gavin McFadden. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis and Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Augusto Fernando Pacheco and also by Maddie Erouge. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. He was the one who was logging on. Next up is Culture with Robert Bound, where we'll have live music from Diane Birch. And we'll also hear from journalist John Savage about his new film, Teenage.
We had plenty of adults saying how dreadful youth were, so if we were going to explore the youth world, or these people groping towards some kind of autonomy, we needed to hear from the youth themselves.
That's all from me, Andrew Tuck. Stay around, plenty coming up. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.